My name is Jeff Thompson, otherwise known as Mithrander for some of the people here who are my friends and know me. I'm a director at a company called Argus Systems Group, and I have a title which is called Software Evangelist and Visionary, which essentially means that I get to stand in front of people like you, jump up and down, wave my arms, and pretend like I know what I'm talking about. Every once in a while I do, most of the time probably not. I'm going to be giving a presentation on how to hack B1 trusted operating systems. And hopefully this will be fun for me and also fun for all of you. I'm going to be using the Pitbull.compact Trust Operating System product suite, and that's a big sentence, which is essentially our company's trusted operating system product as a reference for giving this talk. However, all the things that I will be talking about should be pretty easily translatable to other trusted operating systems. I'm trying to leave it fairly general so all you guys can break into trusted Solaris or Virtual Vault or some of the other fun little OSs out there. Just to tell you a little bit about the company, as I mentioned, it's Argus Systems Group, and we build B1, commercial-grade B1 trusted operating systems. All the work that we do is at the OS level and the kernel level. We really don't do much at the application level. We leave that to other people who want to do things like encryption and SSH and fun stuff like that. So I'm going to ask three quick questions. We have to have a little interactive part so I get a little something out of this. First of all, I'm wondering, like, if you could raise your hands if you've ever heard of trusted operating systems before. All right, that's pretty sweet. I like that. The next one is kind of the kicker. How many people have actually used a trusted operating system? Been on a box, tried to hack one, say, this week? Or, have, you know, just kind of system administrator or whatever? All right, so not quite as many. You guys need to change that, and I'll tell you how at the end of the speech. The next thing is I'm wondering how many people are here who are actually trying to break the box that I brought in. It's a little... Actually, I remember IBM ThinkPad running Pitbull Solaris on there. One guy? All right. Well, you'll learn something. Basically, I should just mention that real quick. What we did is we brought in a Pitbull box for the Capture a Flag competition, and we opened up a web server, put a cheap little messaging board system on it, hoping someone could hack that, threw up IRC, SSHD, Telnet, FingerD, IMAP, POP, SendMail, and I think that's it. And today I just gave away Etsy Shadow with all the passwords in it too, so people should be able to crack those. And the point is really just to kind of demonstrate that you can give what would appear to be the house away on a trusted operating system. And if you configure it correctly, there's nothing that people can do to break into it because of the mechanisms that it provides. So my speech is going to be composed of two parts. The first part I had actually hoped to do during a newbie session, but for whatever reason I didn't get that. So I'm going to have to kind of roll it into here just to give some background on trusted operating systems. I'll try and wing through it fairly quickly and not go into too much detail, but just enough so you guys can understand what I'm talking about. And the second part, which is, of course, methodologies for hacking trusted OS. I'm not going to be giving away any minus one or zero day wares here, so you can't go out and, like, hack all the Swiss banks and stuff immediately, at least. And don't tell them that I taught you how to do this if you go do it. So the other thing is, of course, an assumption I make because it's the Uber hacker, everybody's really smart speech. I'm not going to go into actually how to hack boxes and per se with the old OSs. But a lot of the tools that you have, a lot of the methodologies that you use on old systems are applied directly to hacking trusted operating systems, buffer overflows, things like that. However, the mindset that you have to approach your attack with is very different. And that's going to really be the crux of this speech, is to try and get all of you into that mindset. So to understand trusted operating systems, there's really four concepts which are worth understanding. The first is least privilege, or something else known as capabilities, the POSIX capabilities model, which many of you may be familiar with. An idea of authorizations, mandatory access control, and the idea of putting security into the network layer. And by that I mean into the actual data on the network stack that passes through the system, as opposed to just at the IP layer, which would be filtering. For privileges, there's two concepts that you need to understand. The first is least privilege. And this has actually been written about quite a bit in a lot of security books when there's the little three-page chapter on B1 trusted operating systems, and they mention it as a sort of exotic thing. Least privilege is the idea that rather than having, like on standard Unix systems where you have UID 0 or root, which has complete access to the system, it can override all security on the system, it has access to all system calls. Rather than doing that, you take all the concepts of what root can do and you break it up into privileges. So, for example, root needs to mount a file system. Well, mounting is a concept. It's also a system call. So what you do is you create a privilege which says now that this program or this process can actually mount a file system. And to give you a, kind of a real-world example of that, you can take a web server, and if you want to bind to port 80, you need to run it as root, and then it'll switch to another user. The reason why you need to run it as root is not because it needs to have access to files in the system, simply because it needs to bind to port 80, because it's a privileged port. So on a trusted operating system, instead of setting it as root or giving it total access to the system, you simply give it one privilege, and it can bind to the privileged port, and that's all it needs. The next thing to get into is, this is a little bit of a coding topic. It's the idea of privilege bracketing, but it also affects you when you're trying to break boxes. And it's this, is that privilege bracketing is the idea that a process or program only needs to turn on its privileges or its abilities when it needs to use them. And when it's done using them, it can throw them away. So on standard Unix, you want to throw them away, you become something else besides root. On a trusted operating system, you simply drop the privilege. And now if somebody goes and breaks that program, it's not there anymore, and there's no way for them to get it back. And so now you can limit the exposure in your code, and also where you're really going to need to focus your reviews of your code, your, at least your security-relevant reviews of your code, where privileges are going to be active. And it allows you to start building much more secure software and spend time where it matters in review. So, privileges. Traditional Unix has one privilege, root. You're root, you have everything. You're not root, you try to get root. And with that, there's what we do is we take that idea of root, like I said, and break it up into privileges. So now we have things like a file system mounting privilege, DAC read privilege. DAC is just another word for permission bits or access control lists. It's just kind of an encompassing term. And then you also create new privileges, which are specific to trusted operating systems, privileges which allow you to override mandatory access control rules. Or a great privilege here, and this is kind of a hint if you can get this on a system, PVPVProc. It's a privilege that gives the process an ability to set privileges on other processes. So if you have that, you just start giving yourself lots of nice privileges, and then you can own the system. All right, processes. There's three types of privilege sets that you can have in a process. And the first one is one really important to understand. It's the limiting privilege set. The idea behind the limiting privilege set is that you can specify for a process and all of its children that they can never exceed this amount of privilege. So a great thing to do with this is if you have users logging onto your system who you don't trust, don't ever want to trust, you can give them a limiting privilege set which says no privileges. Now, no matter what that user does, they can run programs that would normally give them privilege. They can do those kinds of things. And when they run them, the kernel will see that they have this limiting privilege set and will refuse to give them privileges. The program may continue to run, but it will run without any kind of special ability on the system or special access. The maximum privilege set is essentially the set of privileges that a process can use over its lifetime. And the effective privilege set is the set of privileges that the process is using at any given moment. So it can raise and lower these privileges in its effective set. When it doesn't want them anymore, it throws them out of its maximum set. And when it doesn't want its children to have any privileges anymore, it throws it out of its limiting privilege set. Now, files, privileges work in a different way on files, and particularly they really work on executables in almost all cases. What you do is you can put three types of privileges on files, and the sets are innate, proxy, and authorized. Innate set of privileges are put onto an executable, and what that means is when that program is run, the privileges in the innate set will be placed into the maximum set of the new program, right? As long as they don't exceed the limiting privilege set, so it's always placed against that. Proxy privileges are simply the set of privileges that if the process that exec the program runs it, only privileges that existed in the process before will be passed on through the proxy privileges. So it's just saying these are what allow this program to pick up in addition to the innate set. And authorized privileges are a set of privileges which a program only gets if the user has an authorization. And I'll explain what authorizations mean in just a minute. So there's lots of privilege stuff. How privileges move, just very quickly, is if you fork a process, privileges carry across the fork. So daemons that have privileges in fork will still have privileges on their children. However, if you exec, then all of the rules for privilege transference come into place, the innate privileges, the proxy privileges, and the authorized privilege sets. And to give another example of that, and this has a large effect on buffer overflow strategies on these boxes, is because you would lose your privileges when you exec, if somebody buffer overflows a program that has privilege, and right now what does everybody do? They use shell code. That's most of the assembly code that's available. Well, when you exec a shell, the shell most likely will not have any innate privileges on it, unless the administrator's an idiot, and they won't have any proxy privileges for most likely for the same reason. So what happens is when you do that buffer overflow, the person gets on the system through that process, but they're not going to have any special access to the system. Now to kind of go through authorizations. Privileges, as I said, are an attribute that's applied to a process, and it specifies what special rights a process has. Authorizations are more of a user-level concept, and an authorization simply says that if a user runs this program, they're allowed to, and it's used in a couple ways, and I'll explain that. One thing that can happen is that a program that's run can look up the user who's running it because it can look at its own UID, and it will say, does the user who's trying to run me have this authorization? For example, is this user considered a security administrator or a system operator? And if they're one of those, then I want to let them use me. And if they're not, then I'll exit and say there's an error. Or I'll only perform a limited set of functionality. Or I'll drop my privileges, or I'll never use them. And so it allows programs to decide how it should operate, not based on who runs them as well. Now there's two sets of authorizations which can be placed onto files, and this violates the rule that I said that this all takes place in user space, because these are two, counterexamples of that. The first is access authorizations. You can say on a file that only a security administrator can run this program. Only a UID who has this authorization is allowed to run this program. And so what happens is when that program's run, the kernel will look and see if the user who's trying to run it has the correct authorization. If he doesn't, he can't run it. And this brings up something else that I should mention about processes. Like the limiting privilege set, there's also a limiting authorization set. And what this means is you can put onto a process, you can say to that process or really to the kernel about the process that it can only have a certain set of authorizations. This is one of the things that we did on the box that we put out there. Anything that's coming in through INETD has a limiting authorization set of login, which means you can log into the system. So you can come in through Telnet, you can come in through FTP, and you can do those sorts of things. However, once you're on there, you can't obtain any other authorization. So if you change to a new UID who would normally have the security administrator authorization, which would mean you could do lots of bad things in the box, you won't have those authorizations even though you're that user. And then the last thing is the privilege authorization set. And this goes back to what I was saying about the authorization privilege set. Just flip the two words. And what this is a list of authorizations placed on an executable that says if this executable is run, then it obtains these extra privileges, and so it gets some special abilities. With authorizations, you create a concept of, and these are really important ones to know when you're going after a box. Kind of historically, they're called ISSO, SA, and SO, and there can be other roles. Roles are simply a concept that you apply to your users to say that these users, should have special abilities on the system. An ISSO is a security officer. They should be allowed to change security on the system. Obviously, this is a very, very trusted account. SA, system administrator, can add users. SO can reboot the system. But we don't need to give them the root abilities that you would have on standard Unix. We just give them the specific authorizations that they require to do the tasks that they need to do. And how that works is that you put authorization checks on the administrative programs. And these programs will then check to see if the right person is running them. MAC, Mandatory Access Control. This is a very boring definition taken from TCSec glossary. TCSec is better known as the Rainbow Series. If any of you have managed to get through all of the books, not just the orange book, congratulations. Actually, I just have a question. How many people have a set of rainbow books at home? Has everybody managed to order them? No? All right. Well, now you want to read about common criteria, which is equally a boring read. But it's good to know about. So mandatory access control is from a historical and a government perspective, is the idea of looking at information and saying that this object on a system, this process or this file, is protected at a certain level. And we all know this is things like this is a top secret piece of information. And then you look at processes or other objects that try to access that information, and you say, I don't care who that person is. It doesn't matter what their UID is. All I care about is that that process has been cleared to access this information. And what that means is that if somebody is in a MAC level, that they can change UIDs, and their access through MAC will not change. And that's very significant and makes everybody else's job very difficult. What happens with Mac is if you create a file, whatever SL or Mac label is on your process, that's how the file will be protected, always. There's no way for an owner of a file to change this. This is very, very different from discretionary access control. Under DAC, if you own the file, you can change its access controls. And the reason why this is useful with Mac is that you can also tie this into the network. And you can say, I have an administrator who's connecting to my system. He has a username and password. He's really smart. He comes through SSH. But because we're using SSH, we may let other people SSH in from the internet because we have regular users on our system. But we also have this ISSO or security administrator who comes in from internally. What you can do is actually apply MAC labels, as I said, to the network layer and say, this administrator coming in internally has one type of access. Well, full access, because we trust people who come in from inside, unless they're corporate insiders and we have a whole different set of problems. But somebody who just grabs this guy's password and comes in from the public internet, we don't want him to have the same access. Under standard Unix, he does. If you're root from the inside, from the outside, from a VPN, you're root. It doesn't matter. Using Mac, you can change that. And I'll explain what those mechanisms are. And again, those will directly affect an attack onto a system. And kind of a corollary to this, something else that occurs, is that the owner of a file cannot give access to his file to somebody else. He can through DAC, but if he copies it through Mac, the file will be at least as well protected as it was when it was the original file. So only people who are cleared for a file can ever see a file. To briefly go through what an SL is, SL stands for sensitivity label. This is the kind of the security object that's used to decide access under mandatory access control in a model that is called the Bell-LaPadula model. There's two components. There's a classification, which is things like you know of probably as unclassified, classified, secret, top secret. And then there's compartments or categories. And they're the same thing, but depending on where you work or where you live, they might be called one or the other. And these are kind of like groupings, where you might say, I have a financial compartment that's being protected, or a cryptography department if you're working for the NSA, or very exciting names like Project A, Project B, and Project C. And SLs are written out with the classification first, followed by a set of compartments. Now, how the different pieces relate to each other. The classifications are, as I said, in a hierarchical relationship so that they can be equal to, greater than, or less than each other. So top secret, is greater than confidential, is greater than unclassified. Compartments work differently. They're actually placed into sets. So you have basic set relationships. They can be subsets, supersets, disjoint, or equal to each other. And that's just basic set theory. Now, a word you're going to hear a lot if you start to play around with mandatory access control is the concept of dominance, of label dominance. And in order for a label to dominate another label, there's two criteria that have to be met. The first is that the label that's trying to dominate the other label, label one dominating label two, its classification has to be equal to or greater, which makes sense. In order for somebody to access a piece of information that's secret, they need to be secret or top secret. You probably wouldn't let an unclassified guy come in and read that. The next piece is that the compartment set has to be equal to or a superset of the other compartment set. On trusted operating systems, essentially, typically, every object on the system has an SL and is protected by MAC. That's not always necessarily true, but typically it is. But most importantly, processes and files will always have SLs, or you're not going to have a very good MAC system. And again, as I mentioned, whenever processes create files, the labels will be placed in the files. And when processes create new processes, the labels will transfer to the new processes. So what happens is when a system boots up, it's going to have to create the init process one. And it's going to put a default SL onto that process. And so now when init spawns off all of its children, all of those processes will have the same MAC label. Well, that's not very useful because now everybody's at the same level and it's not really providing too much protection. So what we do is we put privileges on processes or programs that are going to run like login or SSHD. And what we do is we give those programs the ability to change their own SLs. So now when somebody logs onto the system like I do, it goes and it says, hey, that's Jeff. You know, I'll give him, you know, top secret all access to the system. He can do whatever he wants to me. But when someone else comes in, they can get a different level. And that allows you to put people at different levels in a system and isolate them from each other. And I'll explain how that isolation works. This is how mandatory access control works in the Bell-LaPadula model. In order for a process to read a file, the process has to have an SL that dominates the SL of the file to read. In order to write to a file, a process has to be equal to the SL of the file. It, not dominate, equal to it. And now I'll give you an example of how this applies. If you have a system and you place every file in the system at implementation low, which is the lowest SL you can have on a system, that means every SL dominates it and thus has read access to it. But then you go and you put on login, you say, every user that logs into the system, place them at confidential. Well, now every user who comes on a system has read access, but they don't have write access to any files on the system, no matter what user ID they become, no matter what they do on the system. They only have read access to the system. Processes have two other SLs applied to them. This concept of minimum and maximum clearance. And what this means is simply that the process's effective SL can go between these two ranges. And in fact, the only way for a process to change its effective SL is if it has privileges or it has access to an administrative program that will allow it to change that. Typically, you don't give people the ability to do this because you want to lock them in at a specific SL so that they can't get out and change other pieces of the system. And secondarily, directories and devices have a second SL, which is called a maximum SL. So they'll actually have a minimum and a maximum. Files are single-level containers, so they have one SL. That's the SL that they're protected at. Directories can have lots of files in them. These files can be at different levels, implementation low, top secret all. So you might put a range on a directory to allow people to put more types of information in there. And devices are the same way. Some devices you may want to allow many people to connect to. Other devices you only want one person to connect to, like DevKMem. Now, just to show here, this is the kind of a login example. What will happen on most trusted operating systems is that you'll have a database which will store security information, like a clearance file, which will store minimum, maximum clearance, and then a default clearance or SL that someone would log in at. And under Pitbull, it's stored in Etsy Security Clear, and other trusted operating systems, it's elsewhere. Login and some other programs may give the ability to a user to decide a session level that they would like to connect to the system at. So here we say, set my effective SL to other SL AB, and it can request that. If you want somebody to always and only log in at one SL, you make their minimum, their maximum, and their default the same, and they're locked into this compartment. All right. This is the last bit on the trusted operating system part, and we get to the interesting bits. This is very important because it's significantly different than any of the other mechanisms on standard Unix, and it's the idea of putting access control information in the network layer, not just at the IP layer, but all the way down through, under Solaris it would be streams, but whatever your data flow model is on the OS. And you can place rules on the system which say if data comes in from a specific interface, from a specific host, over a port, using a protocol, basic firewalling rules, then you apply security labels to that. And then what you can do is restrict processes running on the system based on their SLs, who they can talk to because of the security information. And you can also restrict how information go out and how information come in. And this is different, too, than under Unix. Because what happens is once you get, when you're in a system and you do filtering, you can say either people can get in or can come out. But you can't say, I want to allow this process out, but I don't want to allow that process out. So you can do some pretty interesting things with that. This is a very basic example of a network rule. I've cut out a lot of some of the extra stuff that doesn't matter for this talk. You can see from the top part that it's essentially a standard firewalling rule. We specify ports, not mask. Here we're looking at a 192.0.0 network, and we're looking at TCP protocol. The next part that's different, though, from a firewalling rule is the idea of specifying a minimum and a maximum SL range on this interface or on this rule. This is the types of data that you'll allow to flow out of this rule. So here basically we're saying anybody can send information out through this that applies to this rule. However, a very important piece is this default SL, and here it's confidential A. And what this does is it's saying that every piece of data that comes into the system will be marked at this level. So now processes have to dominate this label in order to be able to read the information, to be able to access it. And here's a big blocky diagram kind of summing all of this up to show you why this actually means something.